This is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctor's Digest. It's great to be back with you again. You know, CMDA does a lot of different things. In fact, over 40-some ministries now, but they fall into some key areas. And, of course, our student and graduate ministry, evangelism and discipleship and transformation in people's lives, medical missions and public policy. That would be the three big categories that we're involved in. And on this issue of Christian Doctor's Digest, we're going to hit two of these issues. First, talking about a public policy issue, the commercialization of marijuana. Now, you noticed I didn't say the legalization of marijuana. There's a difference, and you're going to find out a lot of very useful information from Ben Cort, the author of Weed Incorporated. And then we're going to move on to missions, talking about marketplace ministry in missions with Larry McCrary. It's going to be one of our speakers at the Remedy Conference in March, and we'll be telling you about that as well. We've got some good stuff in store. You're going to want to hear this. Stay tuned. Instead of giving you a long introduction on Ben Cort, I'm going to let him introduce himself in this interview. But Ben's got a passion for recovery, prevention, and harm reduction with people struggling with drug abuse. And part of the reason was he himself was a drug user, became sober in June 15th, 1996. He's been one of the best spokespersons on the issue of legalization of marijuana for recreational use across the country, and has a tremendous book, which we're going to be talking about. It's going to give you a lot of information that I think will surprise you and even shock you. Let's hear what Ben has to say. Ben, it's great to have you on Christian Doctor's Digest. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get interested in dealing with the marijuana issue?
Thanks so much for having me, Dave. This is a great honor to be here. I got involved in this initially by just reading the legislation. I think I was like a whole lot of people who were on the outskirts of the issue. When we heard about it, we thought very little about it, but I was given a copy of the constitutional amendment, Amendment 64, that would ultimately pass in Colorado, and was really shocked at what I saw. Before that, you know, I've worked inside of nonprofit drug and alcohol treatment for a number of years, most recently at the University of Colorado Hospital, and that work really stemmed out of my own personal journey to recovery. I got sober on June 15th in 1996, and have managed to stay that way since.
Wow, that's wonderful. You know, you say in your book, decriminalization was really commercialization. What do you mean by that? I don't think most people that aren't in Colorado have any idea what that really means.
That's really one of the key pivot points in this. I think a lot of the times when the arguments are made for the change in laws around cannabis, people think that that is to no longer arrest people who are using and kind of take this burden off of police. But in reality, what we've seen is the money behind it has been absolutely tremendous. The lobby that has pushed all of these laws forward really has done it with the interest of protecting the business. And so decriminalization looks like the no longer arresting and prosecuting people who are just using. I mean, of course, you still go after traffickers, and commercialization is what we've seen here and what everybody else who's looking at this is considering, which is a very large-scale commercial market.
So when you mean commercialization, I mean, it's like commercializing anything. You're trying to sell it. You're trying to create more people who want it or use it more often. Is that a fair description of what's happening there?
Yeah, it certainly is. And this is kind of the problem with big money behind vice substances like this. When you've got such an incredible financial incentive, the desire to increase the user base is significant from the folks who are cashing in on it. And, you know, talking to this audience is nice because I think you guys are a whole lot more informed than most, but the easiest way to convert somebody to a more frequent user or to catch, you know, that 80%. So 80% of the product is consumed by about 20% of the consumers. So the best way to capture that 20% is to get them to start young and to have them use the really strong stuff. And that's just business 101.
Yeah. Talk about the really strong stuff, because, I mean, you know, I was raised back in the 50s and 60s and people used marijuana. It's not the same drug now as it was then.
No, it's not the same drug. That's a great way to say it. And I think a lot of folks, well, we, of course, defer back to our own experiences when we're sort of forming the constructs that we view this through. And if people are limited by their own direct interaction with, or, you know, their uncles or their dads, unfortunately, the model that they have is going to be extremely antiquated. So I think the easiest way to think about it is the percentage of THC inside of the plant. What occurs naturally inside of cannabis is between 0.2 and 0.5% THC. THC, of course, being the part that gets you high. It's the psychoactive component. The marijuana today being sold in Colorado is typically above 30%. And the concentrates, which are the great untold story of this, because every legal definition includes these, and Colorado is actually going to sell more concentrates in 2017 than the plant. The concentrates can be above 95% THC, and we have like absolutely no experience and next to no valid science around what that kind of manipulated high is doing inside of brains and body.
For our members who don't know what concentrates are, explain how that comes about, where it comes from.
So a concentrate, and I would encourage everybody wherever they are to take a look at the laws that are either in their state or are being considered in their state, because the definition of cannabis always includes language like salt, extract, derivative, concentrate. And so a concentrate is basically using some sort of potent solvent, butane and propane are the most effective, to strip the THC out of the cannabis leaves. And what you're left with then is a liquid that's solvent plus THC, and you purge the butane or the propane out of that, and you're left with almost pure THC. That's then cooled into rock form and consumed in a rock. I mean, it's like any other drug that you would imagine somebody smoking in a rock. That's exactly what this looks like. And it's more popular in Colorado than the plant, which I think should be a big wake-up call for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and when I was reading in your book and said, you know, a piece of that half the size of a pinhead will lay a frequent user on their back in seconds. I mean, the potency of this is just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's that was actually an advertisement that I found that the manufacturer said, start by consuming half the size of a pinhead, which is a silly proposal. But in Colorado, you know, as a Coloradan, I could buy 2 ounces at a time of this. And as a non-Coloradan, you could come here and buy an ounce at a time. And there's no desire for people to consume less of it. If anybody wants to go on YouTube and just type in concentrates or dab, so dabbing would be the verb of consuming a concentrate. So dabbing, BHOs, a butane hash oil, and watch what happens, because even very frequent users, until their bodies are used to the concentrate and they've built up a tolerance, they pass out, they vomit. There's a lot of psychosis that takes place right away. They're really an intense drug.
I was amazed, too, to hear they could use this in just a regular vaporizer, what people call electronic cigarettes, and with no smell, be taking this high dose of THC.
Yeah, the vaporizers have been such a game changer when consuming THC. And, you know, one of the things, we actually ran a case study at this at the hospital that I left in January. There was a patient who overdosed in his THC-specific vaporizer, because if it can combust THC at 700 degrees, it also could combust the heroin and the crack that he was using, the speedball in the emergency department, because there's no smell, no warm-up time, no anything. You just pull it out of your pocket and hit it.
Wow. What about all the THC-infused products? That's the other thing that amazed me in the book. I mean, this stuff is in everything you can imagine and at high concentration.
Yeah, the general rule that I like to give folks is that if it can be introduced into the human body, it is being commercially produced in Colorado with THC in it. And there's absolutely no limit to this. I mean, some of your more obscure ones, we're familiar with the candies and the baked goods, but suppositories are fairly popular because it's nobody can detect what's going on. Liquids, sodas, coffees, ice creams, condiments, I mean, THC, coffee, anything in the world that can be introduced to the body. And then, of course, you have issues with how the body breaks that down and the way that it affects a person's psyche over an extended period of time. One of the biggest issues with the edibles is that they often contain multiple doses. So Colorado law agreed that one dosage was 10 milligrams. So it's 10 milligrams of activated Delta-9 THC. And the way that the industry has gotten around that is by putting multiple doses in one package. Last 2 weeks ago in California, I got an ad on my phone on one of the apps that I subscribe to for a graham cracker, and it had 1,000 milligrams in it, so 100 servings. Sodas with 350, gummy bears with 100 milligrams. That's when people end up in kind of a state of acute psychosis that can lead to, best case, admission to the ED, worst case, fatal actions.
Yeah. I noticed you mentioned a soda with 350 milligrams in it and then said, who drinks 1/35 of a soda?
Yeah,
and it grabbed me. I thought, yeah, that's the last time I did that with the Dr. Pepper 10. It's been a while. What about regulation? I mean, you know, everybody tries to say, well, this is safe. It's not hurting anyone. And then I noticed where you said that there's 28 full-time lobbyists in Colorado just making sure there's no regulation going on at all, hardly.
Yeah, I think for some reason this topic has sort of moved outside of normal rational thought, where if people were seeing money like this being made in anything else, we'd think, okay, where's the pyramid scheme? Or if somebody, a drug representative, came into an office and said, this is the miracle drug that fixes absolutely everything, it would raise more eyebrows than it would having people break out their wallets. And for some reason, we're just not questioning enough of what we're hearing, because I think it's because it's become such a socially progressive thing to kind of align oneself with. But the reality is that there's a lot of really intense side effects taking place both individually and societally. And we've got to be willing to look at both the upsides and the downsides of this. And I think have a more honest conversation about what's really taking place in Colorado without having that conversation framed just by the folks who own the industry.
Yeah. I think the other thing that amazed me is the fact that this is a cash-only business. People, those selling this cannot even put the money in the bank. So it's cash on the barrelhead, which creates millions and millions of dollars and all sorts of problems.
Yeah, you know, the example that I often like to give is that 21 years sober and somebody who's taken a much more intentional approach to life with my sobriety and in my own spiritual journey, and I consider myself a fairly honest guy, and I'm not sure that if I were paid in all cash, I would report that all to the IRS. And so that's, of course, one of the easier issues, that there's clearly some tax evasion that takes place in it. But the more significant are in an all cash economy, that sort of brings opportunity to wash money that was made in lots of other endeavors that are less than savory.
Yeah. And tempts a lot of people to robbery, too. I mean, I know there's a lot of money in that place. I'm going to go in and get it. Especially if you're desperate for what you want to smoke or eat or drink.
Yeah, you put drugs and money in the same place, and crime's usually not too far behind.
Ben, talk about some of the effects that you're seeing in the state now. I mean, we've kind of talked about, you know, what's going on with the problem, but I mean, how's this impacting people, children? I mean, I'd be afraid to see my kid eating a gummy bear and wonder where they got it and what might be in it. How's this affecting the culture there?
Well, that's one of the most important ones, is changing the way that we have to interact with the whole world around us. You know, we've gotten used to having the conversation with parents where my kids go over and play that also involve weed. You know, it used to just be, do you have firearms in the house? Do you keep those firearms locked up? And now it's you've got to ask questions about more, because they don't even consider it to be a drug. I would say that the most damaging thing that has taken place, though, from my opinion, and also actually spoke with a friend of mine who's a member of your organization here, a pediatrician, and he validated this, that the most damaging thing that's happening is the generation who's grown up with this as the norm, they see it as a value add. It's not even that it's a bad thing. There's no taboo. They think they should be using these kind of crazy concentrations prophylactically to avoid ever getting sick. So you've got a whole population of young people who at best think that weed is a joke, and more realistically are pretty eager to show how grown up and cool and understanding and progressive they are by accepting everything that's spoon-fed to them.
Yeah. You know, you're working in a hospital there. Were you guys seeing increased number of children and adults in the ER because of this? What about traffic accidents, all the, you know, the things, and psychosis isn't really good to have people running around with either.
Those are the issues that I think are going to be what changes this conversation when people start to realize what's really happening. So I would direct folks to there were several studies that were published out of our emergency department, as well as the largest children's hospital in the state was on the same campus that I worked on. So there were several studies published there, and that's the University of Colorado Hospital. But the best data sets that people can find around accidental and intentional ingestions that lead to psychosis and then EDs, as well as traffic accidents, is just a phenomenal report that's in its fifth version. It's Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. And it's a mouthful. It's RMHIDTA. And it's called Legal Marijuana Coming into Focus. And there have been five versions. So they actually are collecting ICD-9 codes and admissions from hospitals and then publishing that data. And I think it would really surprise most folks to see the amount of psychosis as well as traffic fatalities that are associated with.
Yeah, people say that marijuana will kill you, but it should sure make you do some crazy things and kill other people or yourself. So what's the answer, Ben? I know you're in the forefront across the country with medical groups, psychological groups, law enforcement, talking about this issue, because what do you see ahead, and how should we as healthcare professionals be speaking out on this issue?
Education. And I know that that's a bit of a pat answer that's given far too frequently, but I'll back it up with a couple of specifics here. The consumers are incredibly well educated in one particular bent of this. And I feel so strongly that as healthcare providers, I mean, this is a public health issue. Mm-hmm. As healthcare providers, having relevant and up-to-date information, which means we can't just defer back to what we knew in the 70s. Encourage your hospitals to bring in experts to do grand rounds on it. That's always one of the great joys of my career, because you can get into the depth on it. Have practice groups do in-service learning sessions on this. And then once one is educated, engagement. The healthcare providers in this country are on the forefront of this, and engaging people in a way that's relevant to them. You know, I spent the last hour prior to you and I sitting down on a college radio call-in show, and it is so important that we either initiate this conversation or we be very willing and then informed to have it, because that sort of honest dialogue is going to be the answer. We can't sit back and wait for legislation to fix this. I really think we have to know what the answers are and then bring that truth.
Yeah, and you really create a movement in opposition to what's so being so well-funded and promoted across the country. Well, first thing I would encourage people to do is get a copy of your book. It's got a real catchy title, Weed Incorporated. And I read it cover to cover and marked it with a yellow marker. It is just full of great statistics and information and ways to answer the arguments you hear from people. And Ben, you've done us a great service. Tell us what your website is. Where can people get in touch with you if they're interested in getting you to Grand Rounds or some other event in their area?
I have a website for my consulting company that's called Court Consult, CORTconsult.com. And then I'm also on LinkedIn. I don't do any other social media or anything, but everybody's more than welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn as well.
Ben, I want to thank you for a busy day you're having going from media to media, but thanks for working us in and for all the insights you've given us and for your faithfulness and standing up. This takes a lot of courage and boldness. There's a lot of people out there I'm sure don't like you very much. And I've got some of those people don't like me as well. So I know somehow how this works. And just thank you for doing this and your wife and family for, you know, the travel and everything else that's involved that takes you away from them. But this is an important issue, and you're making a difference. And I just want to say thanks on behalf of our members.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Steve.
I hope you found that interview as intriguing and helpful as I did when I was doing it. But even better than that is reading a copy of Ben's book, Weed Incorporated, The Truth About THC, the Pot Lobby, and the Commercial Marijuana Industry. This was a mind-changing book for me, and I've used the information he shares there in I don't know how many conversations and interviews I've done since I talked to him. The book is available here at CMDA, 888-230-2637, and one of my lovely staff will be happy to help you get that book sent to your home or office. Or if you prefer, go to cmda.org, Life and Health Resources, and you'll find Weed Incorporated listed there. A few clicks and you'll have it in your library. It'll be a fascinating read. I'm glad we're at another TaxWise moment because I always learn something. And we got Jeff Anderson with us. Jeff, it's great to have you here, and thank you for being our CMDA Director of Gift Planning.
Thank you, Dave.
Jeff, we know that so many of our assets, bank or credit union accounts, life insurance policies, retirement accounts, just to name a few, can pass to others by designating a beneficiary of that asset and generally avoid probate. And I've seen this with my mom's estate, which I'm handling right now. One of the most important aspects of our estate, though, in financial planning is making those designations. Can you give us some guidance for that important process that you are seeing mistakes and where you're seeing mistakes being made?
Dave, planning by beneficiary designations is a powerfully effective tool. These designations can even take precedence over a last will and testament, a revocable living trust. You're entirely correct. It can seem like such a simple thing to do, and yet, perhaps because what appears so easy, we just fill out a form, don't we, with an insurance agent or the custodian of our retirement account, for example, and you're done. But there can be a minefield of potential disasters here for our CMDA members. There are some puzzling choices, actions, and inactions that people make, and they take, when it comes to these beneficiary designations.
Jeff, give me some examples.
First, Dave, is probably the most troublesome area, and though it may sound almost unbelievable, that is, we simply forget or we fail to name a beneficiary of an account or a life insurance policy. How can that happen? You and your advisor failed to complete the beneficiary form in his or her office, or the form was mailed to you and you simply neglected to complete it and mail it back because of the everyday pace of life. And, in effect, you've failed to name a beneficiary, of course. So what happens is that the insurance proceeds or the proceeds of an account without a designated or living beneficiary will pass under state probate law to your estate. One of the primary reasons we transfer these types of assets at death by designation is to avoid probate. So you've inadvertently turned what should have been an asset passing outside of probate to an asset that now must be probated.
So what you're saying is by failing to name a beneficiary, those proceeds must be paid and administered by the probate court, which I think would result in delays and more cost.
That's exactly right, Dave. That's the sad news. And here's another big explosion in that potential minefield. You've now put cash from that policy or account into probate that can be used to pay the claims of creditors who file claims against your estate. That's a result our CMDA members most definitely don't want, I think. Also, if you wanted your spouse, children, church, or a ministry to have benefited from your life insurance, for example, then you've thwarted that plan, as now those life insurance proceeds will almost certainly pass via your will and into probate, creating a very roundabout, delayed, expensive way for proceeds to get to family or others as your heirs. And on a related note, that's generally why it's not a good idea at all to name your estate as the beneficiary of an insurance policy or an account.
How important is it, Jeff, to select a contingent beneficiary and do that right?
It's absolutely critical, Dave. None of us know when the Lord will call us to heaven. Suppose we outlive the only initial beneficiary that we had named. Naming a contingent person or church or ministry is a great way to have a backup plan for all the surprises life can bring and yet still carry out our wishes.
Do you see instances where you think people name the wrong person as a beneficiary or don't handle that well?
Regrettably, I do, Dave, and many of these instances involve our children. Let's say you designate the life insurance proceeds to a child, and unfortunately, you have died early and your child is only 19 or 20 years of age, or is even a child who hasn't reached the age of majority, well, there aren't any direct controls or conditions for the child to receive the death benefit from the insurance. His or her new red Ferrari may be sitting in the driveway soon after that life insurance check is cashed, or he or she may be responsible and do great things like go to the mission field. But again, there's absolutely no control or guidance over the child in this way. It's simply up to him or her to make good decisions. And you may have also created a fund that will enable a child's creditors to access the child's new resources to pay off his or her debts. A better result, I think, is to name a trust to be the recipient of those insurance proceeds. Your trustee can give distributions to the child or children over a period of years. And if spendthrift provisions are included in a well-drafted trust agreement, those trust assets are not going to be reachable by the child's creditors. But be careful here, too. Naming a uniform transfer to minor account as the beneficiary, which many people do, that still means that the child has full access and ownership of those proceeds when he or she reaches the age of majority. Finally, for a special needs child, you need to name his or her special needs trust as the beneficiary of a policy or account in order to preserve that child's governmental benefits.
So you've given us a great reminder, Jeff. How do you make sure that your beneficiary designations are complete and up to date? Because probably people are sitting there thinking, okay, I'm not sure I have.
That's right, Dave. We hope they're asking themselves that question. Please visit your financial advisors, retirement account custodians, or life insurance agent to check up on your accounts and policies. Now, much like a diagnostic test in medicine, ask your advisors to send you a written confirmation of the status of your designations. If you then need to make changes, then do so as a top timely priority. These are simple but very effective ways to make sure your designations carry out your wishes and also create good results for your beneficiaries. Finally, there are some serious potential pitfalls when you name a revocable living trust as the beneficiary of your retirement account. As something of a cliffhanger, may I suggest we tackle that important topic and related matters in next month's TaxWise Moment with a part two on this topic.
Jeff, that's a great idea. In the meantime, if people have questions, how can they get a hold of you?
Please call us at CMDA Stewardship, 1-888-230-2637, or please email us at estateplanning@cmda.org. Please always consult your attorney or financial advisor for guidance specific to your individual objectives and needs.
Thanks, Jeff. And until next time when we get together for a TaxWise moment, we appreciate you.
Thank you, Dave.
I want to introduce you to Larry McCrary, who began planting churches in the United States in 1991 and has subsequently been part of 8 church plants. A lot of experience. Also been an international missionary with the International Mission Board in Spain and Germany. He started a number of organizations having to do with missions, helping churches, learning how to engage people with the gospel at home and in other cultures through Upstream Collective. And as part of that, has been very involved in training marketplace missionaries, both for short-term and long-term work. In fact, I know missionaries that Larry's trained. I was so impressed with what he did that I wanted you to hear some of the principles that can help us to be more effective, especially in difficult-to-access countries, either going short-term or long-term as missionaries. Larry, it's great to have you here on Christian Doctors Digest, and we're excited you're going to be at the Remedy Conference. Let's talk about marketplace evangelism. You did this in Europe. You're motivating and mobilizing churches to be involved in missions through your organization, Upstream and Collective. And I just want to pick your brain on how to be effective in that type of missionary work.
Wow, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here and excited about being at Remedy. So in a way, it was an aha moment, Dave. I had been a church planter, pastor here in the States for around 1990 to 2000, and God just really spoke to my wife and I about moving overseas and going into church planting. And so we went with a large mission organization and moved to Spain in Western Europe, and kind of this culture that's, postmodern, a lot of people from the nations living in Europe, and it was very appealing to us to be a part of something, an area and a culture that was religious, but there are not a lot of life-giving churches and believers. And so we go into Spain, and we land in a large city of Madrid, and love it, fall in love with the people, fall in love with the culture. You know, we're raising our kids there. We had these kind of big dreams about what we would be and do. And so, in terms of church planting, and I chuckle because everything just kind of got turned upside down with how that would actually work out. And so in my mind, I was thinking of kind of this missionary team, we'd be able to go in, plant a church. And honestly, and quite naively, I was thinking it would be somewhat like it would be here. And which was just a huge mistake on my part. And so as we started this awakening for us, we recognized that just our presence there as missionaries was not going to be able to impact the very people we were trying to engage, because most of the people there saw no need for a missionary in their own country. They didn't understand that language. There was nothing. It did not make sense to them. There was no credibility on our part in their lives, especially to the secular person there. And so as we were putting together our team and everything, we kind of realized, like, wow, this is going to be hard to do, because we really, our lives don't intersect naturally, especially as men, do not intersect naturally with other men in the marketplace. My wife was having and getting some traction because she was in the culture there, the women would often take the kids to school, and they would have a lot more connectivity. And so we talk a lot about it Upstream, this perpendicular versus parallel pathways. And perpendicular pathways would be that, that type where you just have this divine appointment, and, you just know that God has put that person for you to share and to be able to talk with. Parallel is as you do life, will you work, will you play, will you live? Those sort of things, you're able to have that presence of gospel proclamation in your life. And so we were having a hard time as a team, if you will, trying to engage the marketplace people, which we were, that was our purpose. And so it ended up, as we just prayed through what this would look like, I recognized that actually I had a different team. And so as we started, connecting with different churches and different, from international churches to Spanish churches, God just really placed about 5 to 7 men and women who were global marketplace workers. They were from all over the world. They were from, you know, Sweden, Canada, Hong Kong, the United States, Germany, and they were believers. They loved Jesus. They wanted to follow him. They wanted their lives to make a difference. They wanted to be intentional. And we recognized that actually they were better missionaries than we were, because they actually were able to engage on a day-in, day-out basis with the very people we were trying to engage. We often lack, Dave, credibility as full-time vocational workers, missionaries, however you phrase that. So we lack accessibility. We lack credibility because it just what we do does not often make sense. So I'm not railing against Christian missionaries, because I am one and I've been that. But what I am wanting to lift up is that the need for marketplace workers, doctors, nurses, businessmen, businesswomen, you know, throughout the marketplace to be able to engage in effective ministry, because it's really there. And you have the credibility, you have the accessibility, and you actually have the sustainability in most cases, because you actually have a regular job. You're not having to raise support. So it was an aha moment for me, and I started cultivating these men and women. You know, I would shepherd and mentor, and we would have accountability together. We would talk about strategic direction and opportunities. And in effect, Dave, they became my team. And we started getting a lot of traction, being able to engage, you know, people with the gospel in the marketplace, because not a full-time Christian missionary efforts, but because of marketplace people efforts.
Then when you did that, did you essentially become their pastor, their mentor, their kind of hub for what they were doing? Or did you get into marketplace ministry as well and pick up a job?
No, I did not become their pastor because most were had a healthy church that they were a part of. And we applauded that. We wanted them to have that local connection. I did mentor them and disciple them, I think, in areas of reproducing discipleship, evangelism. Mm-hmm. I did not get another job. In fact, my role was actually overseeing work within that city. And I found a better way to say what I did that actually could make sense to people. But, you know, I was a full-time, you know, vocational missionary, if you will, there. And so that was pretty much my life. Yeah.
What was the impact of the team? I mean, when they kind of moved when you moved this direction, tell us some of what happened and how they became so effective as they did this in the marketplace.
I think one of the things we had to do is help them to start thinking that they were not second class missionaries or missionary light. And the way we had to do that was really help show them that they had a sent identity. And so I think we as pastors, as missionary organizations, even as churches, we've separated, you know, the professional laity to the other 99.5% of the people that's in the church. Mm-hmm. And so we've kind of said that there's this special calling. And if you have this special calling, then you're supposed to do evangelism. You're supposed to go overseas. You're supposed to pastor. And because of that, we've kind of, in a way, marginalized some others, intentionally or unintentionally. I don't know, maybe both. But what we had to do is help people see that it wasn't so much this missionary calling. And I think that there is a calling to go overseas as a Christian missionary. But we had to kind of help reshape that to go that every Christian has the responsibility of the Great Commission. The Great Commission, you know, when Jesus says in Matthew 28, go and make disciples, you know, it's literally in Greek, it's an assumption. It's as you go and make disciples of the nations. And so that wasn't just to a few people. It was given to the church throughout the ages. And so we had to help people see that there's this identity of being a believer, a follower of Jesus, a missionary. And so you have this peace. When you look at Acts 1:8, Jesus says, and you will be my witnesses. It's talking about an identity. You will be my witness. You're a witness. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, you're an ambassador for Christ. Jesus says in Matthew 5, you're the salt of the earth, you're the light of the world. And then later in John 20:21, Jesus says, as the Father has sent me, so send I you. And so what we did, Dave, was really try to help, and we've done this, you know, for the last 15 years of our ministry overseas, and still today, we help people see that they have a sent identity, that each Christ follower has that. And as we can help doctors and nurses and dentists and marketplace people and teachers and artists see that no matter where they're at, where they live, work, and play, whether that's here in the States or abroad, that they can be a witness and they should be a witness. And we help teach them these missionary skills that help them do that regardless. So that's a lot of, that was kind of this initial DNA that I really tried to shepherd them with in those early days. And then, you know, in Spain, you have this advantage of having about a 2.5 hour lunch break.
And then a nap.
And then a nap. So we ate and then, you know, everyone took a nap. But we would meet at lunch and we would meet at different restaurants in different parts of the city and just enjoy a long lunch and conversation. And basically did accountability, community, and strategic direction, just sort of the idea, both in their marketplace, helping them see their own space there where they worked, help them see how they could be intentional in their neighborhood, and then how they could actually continue to plug into their church and ministry. And then from time to time, we would do special projects, and we actually did a project where we were, had a group of people that would meet once a month for a conversation that was kind of an outreach event that we would do. And so you know, it's kind of an individual organic thing, but also it was, in some ways, we put some structure to it.
Sure. How has Upstream Collective then come, you know, as you've come back to the U.S. and now have started this organization to work with churches in this area, how is this impacting churches, not only in sending people overseas, but mobilizing their people at the local level to be the evangelists they should, the disciplers in their own communities, the people that are reaching out and finding people, building friendships, and touching their lives?
So Upstream has actually been in existence, as a nonprofit for 10 years. We started it when we were in Europe. We hope to go back there again someday. The truth is, half of my job and half of my clients are actually still overseas. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work with missionaries, and in fact, one of the key projects I'm working on right now, personally, and taking lead on, is helping missionary teams actually know how to receive people that come over as marketplace workers. Because I'll be honest, a lot of times we don't have a clue. We think differently. You know, we have a different approach to life sometimes. We raise support. We're full-time, you know, in the ministry, so to speak. And so we often see people that are not kind of part-timers. And so as I learned over the years, I spent a lot of my time today, Dave, actually working with mission organizations and missionaries, actually helping them receive well and integrate marketplace people onto their teams, or at least being able to give them that same principle. How do we give them community, give some accountability and strategic direction? And so I spend a lot of my time as part of my leading the organization, my hands-on stuff a lot is overseas working with teams. Now, Upstream as an organization, we really exist to help churches send out healthy workers to, you know, healthy missionary teams. We help churches develop a sending pipeline that actually sees people within the church that with the ability to be able to take their jobs, you know, in other places. Maybe it's in the States, maybe it's in their city, maybe it's across the pond. But we really try to dive into this mission conviction that we all have, this sent identity. So we walk with churches and help them figure out this idea of sending. How do we send people well? How do we care for them? And so we kind of, you know, and I'm putting, we use a book that we wrote about 3 or 4 years ago called Tradecraft, and it really teaches missionary skills to, you know, everybody. And the amazing thing about this book is it is just incredibly have been used broader than we ever imagined. We thought it was going to be just for missionaries and mission organizations, but colleges and universities are using it for their study abroad programs. Church planters are using it. churches that are being planted. You know, the core group goes through it because it really teaches everyday mission skills to the Christ follower. And so we do that. And then the other piece that, you know, we talk about a lot is there's these five components that we feel are critical for a person that is thinking about using their marketplace skills, especially intentionally, maybe with a church plant or maybe moving overseas. And so we need to see a sending church that sees this as a viable expression of mission. And you would think, Dave, that that's a no-brainer, but it's often not. We often see churches that they get the person going overseas being a missionary, but they have no idea what to do with that person going overseas that's working and using their skills that God has given them, their experience or education, to use that intentionally. We often don't know what to do with that category. And we try to help churches see that this is not missionary light. It's not second tier missionary movement. These are people called by God using their skills, and the church is to love them, support them, pray for them, care for them, hold them accountable just as they would a missionary. And so we help churches do that. So that's a critical component. The second is that the person going needs a reason to be there and a means to stay there. And so, you know, it gives them credibility to be there, but it also can give them sustainability. So whether they're a student or they're doing a grad program, they're doing an internship, they're working for 3 or 5 years, they have a reason to be there, but they also have kind of the means financially to stay there. Third is that they do need equipping, and that's where we talk about the trade craft, but we try to help them with security issues. We try to help them. So the project I work with is we work with a sending church. The people that come out of that church in this project, actually, you know, we help them do the equipping and preparing with the missionary skills as, you know, for them when they go overseas. The fourth thing they need is community. They do need community on the ground. They need other people that they can be supportive, you know, talk, care, celebrate the things that community can do. And then the fifth is that we find that they often do need, you know, some strategic direction. And the more specific and strategic that we can be with that and help it to be more tangible, then often we see a more effective result from that marketplace worker that's engaging in that type of work.
If you don't have a clear goal, you'd end up going nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Even
exactly.
In missions. And we've all seen that where they're there, but really nothing much is happening. And, you know, Larry, this is just so key, I think, as we look at what's happening in missions around the world. The most difficult places to take the gospel are where the unreached people are. And you have to have a reason to be there. It's almost impossible in some places to get in as a missionary. And so this is not something on the fringe. This is becoming increasingly the core of missions in many countries. So I want to thank you for what you're doing. I'm excited to hear more at the Remedy Conference as you get into some of the these things in depth and how you teach. And it's going to be very helpful to our members because many of them now are moving around the world or wanting to consider that as a second career as they step down from what they're doing here, or a first career as they finish their training to head overseas. So I'm just thrilled that you're going to be there and give us a lot of insights and practical helps for those considering this at the Remedy meeting. Thanks for taking some time to be with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great to be a part. Thanks.
Speaking of Remedy Conference, let me give you those dates, March 23rd through the 24th. It's going to be held at First Baptist Church, Orlando. They are giving us use of their facilities and just been wonderfully welcoming. Got a great lineup of plenary speakers, over 20 workshops. You know, the reason we're doing this is we know most people come to Louisville for the mission conference there, come within a six-hour drive. So there's whole areas of the country that haven't been reached. Orlando is a rich mission area. Pioneers is based there. Crew is based there. Wycliffe is based there. So we're encouraging students to come down for their spring break and spend a Friday and Saturday morning with us and get invigorated about missions. Encourage you to come or help someone to come. Encourage some students to say, hey, I'll pay the gas money. There's free housing for students. There also is a very low registration rate for students and residents and even missionaries. So come on down and we'll have some great fellowship together, and you'll be inspired to see what God's going to do during that conference. And then don't forget the CMDA's National Transform Conference, April 26th through the 29th, back at Ridgecrest Conference Center. Great lineup of speakers. It's one of my favorite, well, it is my favorite conference of the year, because you see everybody there. It's great to renew friendships. There's good networking going on, wonderful training, and I'm always inspired and renewed. So join us, bring your family. There's kids programs, teen programs, something for everyone there. It's just a great time to get away. And then if you like to travel, well, come with me to the ICMDA World Congress, August 21st through the 26th in Hyderabad, India. The only thing I've ever done is land in the Bombay airport. I'm excited about going to India, see over 1,000 healthcare professionals from dozens of countries around the world who come together to be inspired and renewed and encouraged and find other people of like mind. It's a marvelous Congress, and it only happens once every 4 years, so this is a wonderful opportunity. You can find out more about all these conferences by going to cmda.org. You can register online for the Remedy Conference. Just put it in cmda.org/remedy, and it'll take you right to that page. Hope to see you at one of these meetings. I'm going to be at all three of them, and I would love to see you there. Also, let me mention a few resources. I often ask, what's on your shelf? What are you reading when I'm out? For those of you interested in long-term missions, one I'd recommend to you is Beyond Medicine, What Else You Need to Know to Be a Healthcare Missionary, a book I wrote. I'll plug it anyway, but it's just very practical on all the things you have to do besides medicine if you're living and working overseas. If you haven't gotten renewed in your old saline solution principles and have them expanded on, or you've never taken that course, I encourage you to get CRACE prescriptions. This is the updated version, enhanced version that we filmed with Walt Larimore and Bill Peel. It's great to take medical students through, residents through, colleagues through who have never been it, or just do it yourself to get reinvigorated and repurposed to share your faith and your practice. They've got a lot of great ideas and a lot of other resources that are available online at cmda.org, at Life and Health Resources, or 888-230-2637. If you'd just like to call in, we'd be delighted to help you. As we close, I want to share a couple exciting announcements. First of all, we're in the midst of a membership campaign. We're now at 19,000 members, and we want to take that to 30,000. We believe there's 100,000 people out there that could be CMDA members. And remember, it's not just physicians and dentists. It's pharmacists. It's nurse practitioners. It's physical therapists. Anyone who's a Christian in healthcare can be part of CMDA, and they have different membership rates. That all can be found online at cmda.org. So the best way to get new members is one person tell another person this is a great organization, you need to be part of it. And there's something else exciting you can tell them. We actually have a new opportunity for all our members starting this year. Plans are underway to provide CE activities that will be complimentary for CMDA members. We're already providing 11 hours of CE on human trafficking, and it's on our website, cmda.org/TIP, standing for trafficking in persons. That's cmda.org/TIP. And I'm excited that additional continuing educational opportunities will be developed as benefits for members in the future. Online courses will be promoted on the CMDA website and where continuing education is available through our events calendar. So many of our 41 last year conferences have CME involved with them. And so it's a great way to increase the value of your membership and come to a great conference, have great fellowship, networking, or whatever. And as a bonus, you get some complimentary CE credits. next month, we got some exciting things in place as we're coming out now on a monthly basis on the CMDA app. And know what we did on this one. You can turn to one of your friends and say, hey, download the CMDA app. Listen to this interview. You'd be interested in this one. It's a great way to share and showcase CMDA. But next month, we got John Barnett is a pastor. He spoke at our Continuing Medical and Dental Education Conference for our missionaries. I heard him. I said, this guy is fantastic. We've got to get him at our national meeting. And he'll be our Bible teacher this year. And next month, we're going to have him on with some excerpts from our messages that he's done and give you a taste of what's in store at the national meeting. And then we're going to turn to a public policy topic. You may have heard that the Health and Human Services has a new division in their Department of Civil Rights. It's totally focused on right of conscience. We're going to give you lots of information about that. We're going to have one of our members who was discriminated against in employment and actually spoke at the news conference in Washington. And we're even going to tell you how you can register a complaint if something's happened to you in employment or an educational opportunity or with reimbursement or promotion or whatever. So stay tuned. Next month, we'll get back together again. I'm looking forward to it.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.